So this is the second day of our retreat here at Southern Dharma, Unfettering the Natural Mind, the Path of Clear Seeing. And as I said yesterday, even though the focus of our retreat will be on beyond that, as I said yesterday, the most important thing is the context in which these teachings are absorbed. There are many teachings in Buddhism. But as Patrick Rinpoche said so eloquently yesterday, or crudely yesterday, but quite directly yesterday, as he sort of annihilated all our pretensions at practice, he basically said, if they're not sincerely practiced, every one of these things are just as worthwhile and valuable as goat shit. And so we need to take that to heart. Again, the teachings are precious jewels of great value, but it is the setting in which they are placed that sets them off. We are the recipients of these precious teachings that have been transmitted for thousands of years by human beings just like ourselves. But it is in the context in which we receive them that they have meaning, and that they become alive, and that they have the power to liberate us. We want to jump into the practices. We are addicts for techniques. But as I said yesterday, the most important thing is that we see the big picture. And because of the nature of our deluded minds and the nature of the way the mind operates, which we'll be spending a good deal of time here learning about our minds, it is difficult to get consistency in our both our absorption of the teachings and practices and their practice unless our efforts are diligent and continuous. So as I said yesterday, most of us are seeking help over here. You know, how can I strengthen my meditation? How can I strengthen my concentration? How can I strengthen my insight? Blah, 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 blah. And we want, you know, help over here. But we don't realize that the problem is over here. Right? In the same way, one might reflect, you know, in terms of gardening, right? Commercial gardening, if there's a problem with bugs or disease, you do what? You spray it. Right? You spray it. Very simple. You spray it. Problem solved. But if you have a more organic, natural sense of plants, rather than just dealing with the situation, you may look at what? The soil. You may have the soil analyzed to make sure it's really a nutritive soil. Or does it have to be you know, the things have to be added to it. Does it have to be cultivated? So it's a rich soil, you know, so the plants will grow healthy. Or is it getting enough sun? Or is it getting enough water? Or, you know what I'm saying? All these things. When that could be the problem. That's why it doesn't produce. That's why it doesn't grow well. That's why it's not beautiful. Do we all understand that? So again, in our practice, you know, we want, you know, give me the remedy. It's like, give me the, you know, isn't there something I can spray? Something I can spray on my thoughts, or spray on my actions, or spray on my speech, or spray on my behavior, or spray on my habits, or, you know, isn't there something, you know, that I could take care of it, kill it, right? So I don't have to deal with it anymore. But as again, we know, as we have our poisoned world and our poisoned water and our poisoned soil and our poisoned air, the short-sighted, addiction to instant remedy may not be that beneficial, and it may have costs. And so it is the same with our life of healing and transformation, our practice of Dharma. And this is not, this issue is not new. This issue is ancient, and it is dealt with quite clearly in our tradition. If you ask me, I would say the most important thing that one can be clear about is one's aspiration and intention in this life. Before you jump into all your myriad practices and all your readings, you know, why are we doing this? Why am I doing this? View and outlook are something, you know, well known. If you are leading a worldly life, right, your purpose is very clear, isn't it? Your purpose is what? Accumulation. Right? Your purpose is pleasure. Your purpose is getting ahead, getting more. Right? Avoiding pain. I mean, you know, your purpose is clear. If you live a life that is totally egocentric and narcissistic, your purpose in life is very clear. Right? It's all to get as much for me. No matter where I go, no matter what I do, it's all about me. So again, the aspiration is very clear. Right? Get everybody to like me, get everybody to love me, get everybody to notice me. Right? And that informs all our actions. We know no matter where the narcissist goes, there's a consistency. Right? No matter where the person who only wants to accumulate things and money and status and power over, doesn't matter where they go, where they end up, what relationship they're in, their goal, there's a consistency there. Can you see it? Because their aim in life, their aspiration in life, their purpose in life is always informing their decisions. Is that clear? Just the same way, coming back to something even simpler, the addict. Doesn't matter where the addict goes, what? There's only one thing they want to make sure that they have access to, and what's that? What?
The drug.
The drug. I mean, it doesn't, you know, they're very consistent. And they'll take it from anybody. So, you know, we have to respect that consistency in life. So we have to ask ourselves, if these are the kind of unconscious aims and purposes of life and meaning of life that seem to be offered by our society, and which people consciously or unconsciously are always fulfilling, If I have come to the point where I find that essentially meaningless, those types of pursuits, or if I come to the point of view that they are actually sources of suffering, you know, just coming to that conclusion is not enough. Because that energy that we have always cultivated consciously or unconsciously in our life is still what is motivating us. And so what many people do is they come to a spiritual path, they come to Dharma, and they kind of graft that on top of it. Right? We don't really transform this. We go, oh, Dharma, that'll make my life better. Right? I'll just put it on top. And then we wonder why our Dharma life, you know, as Pachu Rinpoche said yesterday, you know, if you're doing meditation, your obscurations should be lessening, disappearing. If you're doing the practice, you should be there should be less sense of separation, of duality, of self and other. There should be less self. I mean, this is the result of practice. If we're not seeing that, if we're seeing that our Dharma and our mindfulness are all kind of you know, coming into the context of our life only to kind of on a superficial level, we have to wonder why is that, or if I'm still having the same issues. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, still the same issues, still anger issues, still fear issues, still self-esteem issues, still inner child wounded issues. We have to ask ourselves, you know, why is this not healing? Why am I not being transformed? I mean, this is a practice that talks about you start out as a deluded sentient being and you end up a Buddha. Right? Isn't that what it says? At least in the text that I've read, that's what it says. Well, if that's what it said, then if it's a valid path, it has to deliver. Right? Or why practice it? So, if it's not delivering, either the path is invalid, right? Or the way I'm going about it is not the way that it's, you know, that I'm supposed to be going about it. So, you know, and to me, it's aspiration. It's the big picture. You know, where am I going in life? Now, there are many paths in life. I'm just going to talk about the Dharma path in life, the path of healing and transformation, the path of awakening, the Bodhisattva way. See, if that's your path, then it should inform everything you do. In the same way, self-centeredness informs everything the narcissist does. Accumulation of things and, you know, materialism informs everything the materialist does, right? They're very consistent. So there should be always a consistency in the way we are living. And it is informed by the big picture. See, if you're practicing the Bodhisattva path, if you're practicing the path of mindfulness, concentration, insight, that's your path in life. And whatever you're doing, you know, you're cleaning house, you're going to work, you're volunteering, you're having dinner with people, you're going on vacation, you know, that's all external, right? That's what you're doing. But inwardly, you're cultivating the Bodhisattva way. In every experience you have, you're cultivating patience, you're cultivating understanding, you're cultivating compassion, you're cultivating letting go, you're cultivating non-self, right? Whatever you're doing, because that's your intention in life. So you're not fooled by the world of activity, because you understand that you are seeking something else in your life. You're not fooled by the trinkets that are offered in life, the so-called rewards, right? Because you have a deeper understanding about the ultimate unsatisfactoriness of those. So in Buddhism, going back to the Buddha himself, we begin with suffering. And the purpose of the practice is the ending of suffering. So there is kind of a first intention. Yeah, my purpose in life is to end my suffering. And again, as you know, suffering does not just mean the gross emotional sufferings, depression or anxiety or, all that, more heavy, anger. And, it's just a suffering of change. It's a suffering of not getting what you want. It's a suffering of getting what you don't want. It's a suffering of feeling alone, the suffering of feeling separate from, the suffering of feeling disconnected from life, from nature, from people. There's very subtle levels of suffering. The suffering of just feeling that you're a self, separate and alone from everything else. So, to really understand that it doesn't matter how much money you have, how many spa treatments you have, how many wonderful vacations you have, how many new cars you have, how many kitchens, granite top kitchens you have, how many, what are those shiny metal kind of appliances everybody's into. It doesn't matter how many of those you have. That will never ameliorate the kind of suffering we're talking about. Even if you get your ideal job, even if you get your ideal relationship, it still will not. These are temporary. So, the commitment to ending your personal suffering is at the core of practice. Therefore, we cannot run away from our suffering. We can no longer paper over our suffering. We can no longer deny our suffering. We can no longer suppress and repress. We can't use our practice, as so many people do, as an escape from our suffering. We need to fully embrace our suffering, because our suffering is the path to our awakening. But then, it doesn't stop there, does it? Because we have the capacity to look around. We have the capacity to notice, oh, I'm not the only one who is suffering this. So when you're suffering, maybe you're depressed, maybe you're anxious, maybe you're lonely, maybe you're angry, maybe you've been hurt, maybe you've been betrayed, maybe you're sick. I mean, maybe. You're not one of those who it's only poor me, but you realize, oh, millions and millions and millions and millions of people experience this. People I know. Family members, loved ones, friends, colleagues. They know this suffering too. So, for me only to think of ending my own suffering and just having no sense of of commitment or relationship or connection to all these others, how utterly selfish of me. Right? Because I understand that the suffering that I experience in life, there's a universality to it. Oh. So now we've taken the path of personal suffering to the next level, which is the Bodhisattva path, which includes everyone. My healing and transformation, my awakening and freeing myself from suffering is not only for me. It is to benefit everyone. Because I realize whether people are rich or poor, whether they're in this ethnic group or that ethnic group or this religion, they all suffer equally. In the way we're talking, this kind of emotional suffering. So now when you're a bodhisattva, when you enter the world, you don't enter the world, I like this one, I don't like that one, this one's a jerk, you know, that kind of mind. But it's like, oh, well, of course, they're acting like this. They're all suffering. How can I, is there anything I can do to help them? So this this purpose in life, this aspiration in life, to be fully awake, which means to be fully freed of all your suffering and all your delusions, and that your mind and body is free of all that. So you truly exist in a state of well-being and wisdom and understanding and compassion and openness on a consistent basis. And again, enlightenment is not a thing you get. It's not a diploma. It's not a geographic state. Enlightenment is something that occurs moment to moment. You're either awake or you're asleep. You're either enlightened or you're deluded. And that is a moment-to-moment opportunity that everybody in this room has. And even if you were the biggest deluded fool a minute ago, in this moment, you have a chance to do it differently. This room, in past years in our community, we have had intensives and we have read and studied Shantideva's The Path of the Bodhisattva. Maybe others of you are familiar or read about it. But again, just reading about it, or calling oneself one, or saying one's on the path of one, is not the same as really being one. Again, to be a bodhisattva means that the aspiration to be of benefit to others, the aspiration to know that the best way that I can benefit others is by awakening my own mind, freeing myself from all my own delusions, means that that's what you wake up with every morning. It's not something you just repeat once a day. It's something you wake up with every morning. It's your intention every day. And it is what informs all the interactions and time spent of your day. Is that clear? It's an aspiration that suffuses your life and informs how you are in the world. And again, it doesn't mean that you don't go to work, and it doesn't mean you know, do all the things you do, but it means the way you go about it is very different. For example, when we are faced with difficult times, the Bodhisattva is grateful. When you're faced with difficulty, the Bodhisattva is grateful. When people treat you unkindly or say unfair things about you, the Bodhisattva is grateful, because these are all opportunities to heal and transform that self. We are grateful for opportunities. When stuff arises, painful stuff arises, in the course of retreat, people will experience things like that. The Bodhisattva is grateful. Oh, I didn't know I had so much hurt in me, sadness in me, anger in me, fear in me. I didn't know I was still so holding on to that. Oh, I'm so grateful that it's come up. Because now, having the tools that we have, I can heal and transform that. So we are grateful. We don't. We're not bothered by it. Many people are bothered. I'm so sick and tired of dealing with my stuff. I mean, it's your stuff. It means it's your stuff. It's our stuff to deal with. And it's often the reason we're still dealing with it is because we really haven't been very consistent in our application of the teachings and practices. We're still holding on to something. We're still identifying with something. We're still stuck somewhere. So again, aspiration is key, and in Buddhism, this wonderful vision that unites a personal transformation, personal freedom of suffering, with this altruistic wish to benefit all people, the bringing of these two streams together is quite wonderful. And it is something that has given meaning and purpose and joy to, you know, millions of people for thousands of years. But again, it's something that needs to be cultivated. As is said in Buddhism, that everybody has the seed of bodhicitta within them. Seed. Seed means small. Seed means small but full potential. It's all there in the seed. Right? Full potential of the oak tree is in the acorn. Right? What a miracle. Right? To see an acorn and know it is a mighty oak. It's all there. Right? All I need to do is what? Cultivate, take care of, cultivate. And it will grow. Because the potential's in the seed already. Each of us already have the potential within us for Buddhahood. The seeds of a delusive human being and the seeds of an awakened being are all within our mind. The seeds are there. It is a matter of what am I cultivating? Day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, experience by experience, what am I cultivating? Am I cultivating the seeds of awakening, or am I cultivating the seeds of delusion? Am I cultivating the seeds of self, or am I cultivating the seeds of selflessness? You know, what am I cultivating here? Am I cultivating the seeds of affliction, or am I cultivating the seeds of emotional well-being? I mean, what am I cultivating here? When you have a clear purpose in life and an aim in life, you have a big picture that informs you in all the little, you know, moment to moment, day to day, hour to hour experiences of life. If you don't have that, you're just winging it. So, this altruistic aspiration, the bodhisattva aspiration, the cultivation of the bodhi seed, is the purest aspiration that one can have in this life, and ultimately will bring us the most benefit, the most happiness, the most joy, the most meaning. It is a life of purpose. Now, we are all born into life, right? This thing we do, you know, from birth till death, that's called life, right? And you might notice there are like billions of other people running around this planet, also doing the same thing between their birth and death. Okay, so that's what's going on here. Just being very simple-minded. You know, 6, 7, 8 billion people running around living their life. This one does this one does that, but, you know, this culture does this group does that, you know, that's what's going on. Everybody's just living their life in between birth and death. They weren't doing it before they were born, and once they're dead, they're not going to be doing it. So it's short term. But during the short term, every sentient being has their life, which most people take very seriously. Now, so lots of running around, lots of activity, all these human beings, you know, doing this and that. You know, if you look at it, it looks like a lot of, you know, everybody's running around. If you ever look at them, right? Everybody looks very serious. I mean, whatever they're doing, they're going about it with great seriousness. Doesn't matter what country you go to, you know, they're just running around doing whatever they're doing with great seriousness. Great. Okay. So it's very easy. Kind of not to see the big picture. Like, what are they really doing? You know? I mean, they're very active. But what are they really doing? You know, what's really going on here? See, these are the big questions. You know, what's going on here? Luckily, we have some guidance. And again, those of you who've been around a while have heard about the four mind turnings, the four thoughts that turn the mind away from suffering. You know, so that's a very potent, these four thoughts, and they are traditionally, they need to be contemplated. Now again, there are many people, or again, like I said yesterday, you are probably thinking, here he goes again, these four thoughts. I've heard them so many times, I know them, I can repeat them myself. Again, as you know, a parrot can repeat words without any understanding. So it's not just the words, it's like, do we really understand it? Because if we understand the four thoughts of enlightenment, I mean, the four thoughts that turn the mind away from samsara toward enlightenment, our life condition and the energy and where we put our energies would be very different. So I am going to, please indulge me. Well, I take a few moments at the beginning of this retreat to restate them. We have a body, right? That's all human beings have bodies. This is something we, right? Now, what is this body for? See, what is this body for? You know, is it to attract the opposite sex? Is that the purpose of the body? Right? Is it to impress people? Is that the purpose of the body? Is it to indulge sensual pleasure? Is that the purpose of this body? Is it to protect me? Is that the purpose of this body? You know, what's the purpose of this body? in Dharma, this body is called the precious human body. Why is it precious? Because having a human body, we now have a vehicle to support us in our transformation and awakening of our minds. Right? There may be other realms where minds just float around, do whatever minds do when they don't have a physical body, but we seem to be in a realm here where a mind must have a body. And so this body is a vehicle for our awakening. And the precious life of the body is a vehicle for our awakening. And then in the teachings, as you know, that's very well delineated in terms of freedoms and opportunities. But if this body because of good karma has been born into a place where it was able to be nurtured and kept healthy so it could grow. If it happened to be a body that because of its good fortune has enough to eat and has all the basic conditions of life supported have been given to it, and if this body is born in an area, a geographic area, where the Dharma has been taught and is still being taught, and where teachers are still teaching the Dharma, and there's opportunities to practice, this is quite a wonderful opportunity for this body of ours. And if we have the freedom, because we are not constrained by mental or physical disabilities or diseases or other kinds of deprivations, that we have the opportunity to fully engage in the process of transformation, we understand this is the purpose of my body. This is the purpose of my life. I have been given a rare opportunity in this life. A rare opportunity that most people do not have, and a rare opportunity which is fragile. We do not know how long this opportunity will be available to us because of the nature of one of the other mind turnings. So I look upon my body and its life as a vehicle for awakening. As a vehicle for supporting my transformation. So I take good care of it, but I'm not obsessed by it, and I don't misuse it for satisfying emotional needs. That is a misuse of our bodies. Nor do we abuse our bodies. But nor are we obsessed by our bodies because we understand other things about it. So it is important that we see and believe by contemplation that we have incredible good fortune. Everybody in this hall has good fortune. And I'm not saying that kind of rah, rah, rah. This is not a corporate meeting where I'm, you know, rah, 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 we all got good fortune. Well, this is true. Everyone here has, because of their life condition, the fact that we can come here for a week, that we can take a week off from our life. And we are very fortunate, aren't we? The fact that these teachings and practices are available to us and are still being taught, and that we have direction shown to us by our teachers. The way is not something ancient to be read about. The way is something that is practiced right to today. You know, we are incredible good fortune. Now, you might say, oh, I get it. But if you get it, you would wake up every morning with that awareness. I'm alive another day. The conditions of the precious human life are still available to me. Let me use this day wisely. These mind-turning reflections are energizers. You know, many people, their practice lacks energy, or, you know, when things are rough, then they get energetic in their practice, and when things kind of smooth out, they slough off on their practice, you know, or they get fired up, they go to retreat, all of a sudden their practice is energetic. A week later, it's all, you know what I mean? It's like this, back and forth. Because there has to be an energy that comes from within. And it comes from the aspiration and from these mind turnings. And we need to do them until the transformation occurs. Until the energy is now just flowing of its own. But until that point, we have to cultivate it through this type of reflection. So there is this precious human life and its opportunities and freedoms that we have all, everyone in this room has. Don't take it for granted. All of us know people, healthy one day, quite sick the next. All of us know people, even in our Sangha, full of life one day, near death the next. That is available, that turn in life is available to all of us. We do not know, do we? But we can through the observation of life, we can see beyond our narrow view, and that's a wake up, which leads me to the next reflection. This is a big one. Impermanence. Everything changes. This body of ours that we most identify with, that we're most attached to, is impermanent. It is fragile. It is subject to sickness, old age, and death. And along the way, I mean, there may be people here just up here in the last couple of days may have, right? Physical things going on from meditation, sitting, from the food, maybe some insect bit you. I mean, you know, it's just, we can't go anywhere without this body giving us trouble. I mean, it's a source of trouble, right? Be walking along very nicely, enjoying yourself, and trip and fall, hurt yourself. I mean, it's just, you know, the opportunities. You go have a good meal, a couple hours later you wish you didn't. You know, I mean, this is the nature of it. So again, impermanence is the great fire that is raging through life. It is the great fire that rages through individual lives, through relationships, through societies, through history. It is unstoppable. Because it is a fundamental truth, capital T, about the nature of this life. It is constantly changing. There is nothing that we can, in this life, that we can say, this is stable and permanent. Is there? No. Because of death, we understand that all our dreams, all our aims, all our acquisitions, all our friends, all our family, all our loved ones, all of them, we have very limited connection with. We will leave everyone and everything behind. That is the truth. And they will leave us behind. You know, some couples go, I want him to go first. No, I want her to go first. Either way. That is the truth. And the truth of impermanence is significant. To see that all the things we built are built on sand. And that everything that we hold dear and precious, none of it has any stability. Right? We all know that, don't we? When we're willing to stop and be honest. So there's something very profound in that, in terms of, well, then, if this world is constantly changing and I can't depend on anything, and what's here today could be gone tomorrow, including my health, my well-being, people, things, right? And now we talk about what? Now they're talking about, with all this global warming and sustainability, that we may, you know, even the planet may go, right? The very Earth that has sustained us may no longer. So, I mean, lots of impermanence. Well, how do I relate to that? I could ignore it. I live in a world of denial. I could go to the other extreme and just say, I'll just grab as much as I can right now. Or I can respond in a very different way. But the meditation and reflection on impermanence is very important. Because things appear, right, solid and permanent, don't they? Like right now, doesn't this appear solid and permanent? I mean, the world of appearance looks solid and permanent. It is only when we look deeply or under the surface that we see the true nature, the true characteristics of this world of phenomena. That's what we're talking about. And we see when we look more deeply that that which appears permanent is impermanent. That which appears solid is really not solid, but made of parts. That is worth reflecting on, because that is something that is not readily seen. Things appear different than they really are. The next contemplation is the ultimate kind of unsatisfactory of what's called samsaric life. Samsaric life, we might say, is worldly life. And again, you can see these kind of feed each other. So, what does that mean? Why is worldly life ultimately unsatisfactory? Right. I would imagine many people in here, if not everybody in here, has tried their best, right? Everybody in here has tried their best to achieve worldly goals. And yet, here we are. Why is that? Is it because we just don't, you know, we just don't know how to play the game? There are many workshops out there and books out there trying to help you play the game better. That's your problem. You just don't know how to play the game. It's probably made Tony Robbins a billionaire by now. Or is the game fundamentally flawed? Is there a flaw in it so glaring that it's apparent to anybody who looks deeply, and yet because of false consciousness, people just, it's like the emperor's new clothes, right? Nobody wants to say the emperor's naked. Only the little boy can do that. The eyes that see fresh, the eyes that are innocent, the eyes that have not been contaminated, can clearly see the emperor has no clothes. So in this life, we want to gain, we want to get ahead, but we are unhappy when we lose, or we fall back, or somebody gets ahead of us. In this life, we want pleasure. We don't want pain. In this life, we want success. We don't want failure. In this life, we want to gain, and we don't want to lose. And yet, you can't have one without the other. We want to acquire things, but ultimately they do not give us real happiness or satisfaction or meaning. The happiness we get is fleeting. It may last an hour, it may last a day, it may last a couple of weeks or a month, but eventually it will dissipate. And we'll have to start all over again. A human being is always, always creating a world for themselves where there's something they want, there's something they need. In Buddhism, that is called, you know what? The mind of dissatisfaction, the mind of discontent. We live in a society where, without naming it that, it's always about do this, get this, buy this, go on this, have this, and then your discontent and dissatisfaction will disappear. You'll be happy. But that's not true. You all know it's not true. So to see the fundamental unsatisfactoriness, and that the activities of the world that promise satisfaction and meaning and purpose are delusory, is very important. Because we know as practitioners that contentment and discontentment, satisfactoriness and unsatisfactoriness, happiness or sadness, are all what? States of mind. It's all about this. Right? It's not about that. They're promising what's already here if you get that. But that will never give us what's already here. Right? The healing and transformation, the change, the meaning, the purpose has to be found here. That is why fundamentally there's no, ultimately, any real meaning or satisfaction out there in the world of phenomena. Because the world of phenomena is simply a reflection of our own minds. And we are creating this whole phantom of meaning and purpose and goals and objectives out of in our own minds. So this getting that meaning and purpose and happiness are not found in the endless activities of samsara, but are found within one's own mind, and that one needs the tools of meditation and mindfulness and insight and the six paramitas and et cetera, to mine the treasure we already have, is a fundamental shift. It doesn't mean you go out and quit your job tomorrow. It doesn't mean you leave your relationships tomorrow. But it means one understands, you know, that if I'm looking for happiness, meaning, peace of mind, etc., that's here, and it's not dependent on that. As long as our happiness is dependent on that, and if you find that your mind goes up and down, you're happy, you're not happy, you're peaceful, you're frustrated, you still haven't gotten this one. Even though you might have reflected on these many times, because you're still sucked in. We're still getting sucked in. We still have forgotten these fundamental teachings. Because when we really understand just these teachings that I've just shared, there's a fundamental letting go, a fundamental shift in priorities, and that it's not a struggle. People still struggle. I got to rebalance my life. Well, if you got to rebalance your life, something's out of balance, and it's not your life. It's your mind, because you're still, you know, anyhow, I think you understand what I mean. Fourth and final of these mind turnings, thoughts that turn the mind away from and towards, is the law of cause and effect. Again, you know, what I said earlier, what's going on in this life? Right? What's operating out here? Outwardly and inwardly. And again, the operating principle is cause and effect. Very profound. Again, is there anybody here who's never heard of the law of cause and effect? No. We've all read about it, we've talked about it, we've reflected on it, and yet we still do not live our lives with that understanding. As Patra Rinpoche pointed out to us yesterday. The law of cause and effect states, every cause has an effect. Every effect is the product of causes. Right. And whether that is on a historical world stage, or whether it is on an interpersonal stage, and whether it's on a personal stage, or whether it's just in terms of one's own mind, everything that exists now is the product of all types of variables, all types of causes that have created this to be what it is. Is that clear? When you understand that, in a certain way, there is a profound acceptance of the way things are, of people, of situations, even of oneself. I mean, there are many people, and some may be in this room, who have problems accepting themselves. I mean, can you believe that? They think somehow they should be different than they are. Right? How could we be different than we are since it was causes and conditions that have created us to be who we are? Right? I mean, isn't that kind of crazy? Why do I have the mind that I have? Why do I have the thoughts that I have? Why does this come up and why does that come up? Why is it? Because they've come up before. We've thought it before. We've obsessed about it before. We've ruminated about it before. We've fantasized about it before. You know, causes and conditions create us, our minds, our bodies, our situations, and everybody else's. Why are they the way they are? Why do they act the way they do? Causes and conditions. You know, why aren't people nice to one another? Right? Why do they do such mean, cruel things to one another? Causes and conditions. Again, I mean, the causes and conditions can certainly be delineated for understanding and transformation, but at the bottom line, it's the same operating principle. Now, it is important to understand that karma is not fate. Karma is not predetermination. Karma means that, for us, that because of the impermanent nature of things, right? All the causes and conditions that have created us up to this moment, none of it is permanent. That's why when people come to me and talk about their habit energy, I say, show me your habit energy. And people go, what? Well, I can't show it to you now. Doesn't seem to be around. But you know, it's not around because it's not permanent. It's not solid. It's not a thing. Because of impermanence, because of non-self, because of insubstantiality, that is why change and transformation is possible. Right? That is why a deluded, ignorant, sentient being like ourselves can become Buddhas. Put ourselves in different conditions that nurture different seeds, consciously create a whole sets of causes to create a different type of mind, a different kind of pattern of speech, a different kind of pattern of physical behavior, learn to deal intelligently and wisely and transformatively with the ripening karma from the past. There it is. You know what that's called? The path of practice. Right. To understand the law of karma is a wonderful thing. It is optimistic. It is hopeful. Can you see? It's the most wonderful thing because it shows us, oh, you know, yeah. Now I get it. I just need to be cultivating different seeds, different mind states, different thoughts, different way of speaking, different way of behaving, different way of acting, different way of interacting. Oh, I can do that. Oh, I just got to change my priorities around and what I do with my life and what kind of situations I put myself in. Oh, I can do that. Oh, the more we do that, the more speedily transformation and healing occurs. The less we do it, the slower it will occur. Right? If every time an afflictive thought or emotion or mind state arises, we see it clearly, we name it clearly, and we handle it, and there are many ways of handling it, but in a way that transforms it, transformation occurs. It's as simple as that. If we have 100 afflictive mind states or thoughts arising in a day, and we're only attentive to 3 of them, on the other hand, if 100 are coming through a day and we're attentive to 97 of them, can you see the difference in terms of your transformation and healing and the quality of your mind? This mind of ours, at its very base, is a mirror. It simply reflects. But it is the nature of this mind that it receives impressions from our actions, our thoughts, our emotions, our words, and the actions of our body. We leave impressions. These impressions over time accumulate. Many of them harden, and we end up we end up with what we got. Again, knowing that that's all that's going on, to be very diligent and in our mindfulness of really attending to what's arising in the mind. And knowing that if I handle it differently, if I respond differently, I am transforming, which often means for the past ones and the afflictive ones, weakening, softening. And at the same time, I am cultivating a repertoire. You know, this is the Eightfold Path, this is the 6 Paramitas, this is the 7 Factors of Awakening. You know, when I'm cultivating that, and that's where I'm putting my energy. And I've stopped all this endless obsession with our afflictions. Right? Why be obsessed about our afflictions? Let's be obsessed about something positive. Something has the power to transform us if we want to be obsessive about something. Right? So, again, to reflect in this way on the preciousness of this life and the opportunities that are available to us, to reflect on this life, on the impermanent, transitory nature of all experience and all things, to reflect on this life, on the fundamental unsatisfactory of worldly life, and to understand the law of cause and effect and how it operates in life and with our own mind. When we really reflect on this deeply, consistently, daily, it turns the mind toward a life of meaning and purpose. And if we have become acquainted with the Bodhisattva way, we understand what could be more meaningful than that? Right? Not only do I find my own way out of the mire of my own delusions, my own egocentricity, my own sense of disconnection and alienation, but I know how to help others, people I love, people I care about. I can help them establish a life of meaning. We see our so many of our family and friends lost in their sufferings, lost in their stories that they think are so real, stories about themselves and stories about everyone else. I mean, some families, people can't even get together and enjoy each other without creating some kind of drama, some kind of conflict. Somebody's hurt. Somebody's this. Somebody's right. That's right. Things haven't improved much since kindergarten, have they? So, I happened to be at breakfast this morning, and having thought of what Patrick Rinpoche pointed out, I noticed these five contemplations lying on the table in front of me. And I thought, this is interesting. Here is the wondrous path, and we recite it every day. And do we just mouth the words? Or do we really reflect deeply on what we're saying? You know, do we just, you know, recite the words and then we just shovel it down? Talk about a disconnection. Thank God Patrick Rinpoche is not here. He'd be just jumping all over us. This food is the gift of the whole universe. Now, when these words are said, do we look at the food and do we eat that way? Knowing that the whole universe, the whole universe manifesting as this food, rain and earth and sky and sun, all manifesting as this food, right? Do I eat in that awareness? The earth, the sky, numerous living beings, much hard loving work. I've never liked loving work because I don't know. I don't know if everybody who picked the food were loving, but I know they worked hard. May we eat with mindfulness and gratitude so as to be worthy to receive it. So there's the quid pro quo, right? The earth freely gives up its bounty. The whole universe transformed into soup and salad, casserole, right? This great freely offered gift to the universe. You see, you know? I mean, the grains and the fruits, nobody's paying them, right? To grow and put forth such all the things that sustain us. I mean, nobody's paying them. They do it freely. I mean, that's pretty incredible. Right. Who here would work for free? The earth, the sky, they work for free. So may we eat with mindfulness and gratitude, so be worthy. So that's the deal, right? The universe gives its bounty freely, and so I don't hurry. I'm present to it. Somebody's labored to bring it to me. Somebody's labored to cook it and prepare it and chop it. Yeah, I want to acknowledge that as I eat it. And I want to be grateful for the efforts of others and for the earth. So, again, it's telling us, you know, how to eat. Is that clear? May we recognize and transform our unwholesome mental formations, especially our greed and learn to eat with moderation. All right, so, oh. See, not only am I eating in mindfulness and gratitude with an acknowledgement of the gift of the universe, but I'm also attentive to my unwholesome mental formations that may get in the way of that wonderful eating in mindfulness and gratitude. Greed. More for me. More tastes. More sensual pleasure. More filling up the hole. Is that why we're eating? Especially our greed. What kind of mental formations come up when we eat? Are we attentive to them? Learn to eat with moderation. May we keep our compassion alive by eating in such a way that we reduce the suffering of living beings, preserve our planet, reverse the process of global warming. So this is also about eating. Yeah, so how do we reduce the suffering of living beings? Well, we could say by not eating meat product or fish or fowl, and because when life is taken, that is suffering. So we could say by eating vegetarian or eating vegan, we are reducing the suffering of living beings. Perhaps by eating foods that are organic, that haven't been sprayed or, grown with the aid of petrochemical this or that, we are contributing to, preserving our planet and making it more sustainable and our waters, right? So, okay. That's also involved in eating. It's an expression of my compassion for living things such as animals, etc. And it's also, I eat with an awareness that my eating and the things I eat and the products I buy does have a relationship to the well-being of the planet and its sustainability. And finally, the fifth is, we accept this food so that we may nurture our sisterhood and brotherhood, strengthen our community, and nourish our ideal of serving living beings. Here it is again. You see it? Here it is again. It's right here. We read it every meal. The altruistic aspiration. Oh, that's the context in which I'm eating. Eating my breakfast at Southern Dharma, eating my lunch in Southern Dharma, eating my dinner at Southern Dharma. Oh. So I can, with the nurturance and the energy I'm receiving from this food, what am I going to do with it? Well, I'm going to nurture my connection to other beings, sisterhood and brotherhood, strengthen the community that I live in, and continue to nourish our ideal of serving living beings. Oh, that's what I'm eating for. So, probably almost everything I've talked about today is in these five contemplations. But we have to be very careful that we get lost in words and we don't touch meaning. Right? These words have wonderful meaning. And that if we touch the meaning of them and then practice them every meal, that is significant. Transformation will occur even as we're eating. So this is just a little example, right, of how to bring awareness and consciousness and intention and aspiration to this act that all human beings take part in, right? We all eat. But we're using this eating as an opportunity to transform our minds, our hearts. Is that clear? Good. Any questions? Good. So please, please use time, solitary practice, other times, to reflect deeply, do not feel that somehow our practice is just, being present.
Two,
mindfulness is part of the path, but this path is very much about this type of reflection. And one can do it mindfully. One can do it, this type of reflection, with concentration. You can bring mindfulness and concentration to this kind of reflection. Is that clear? Don't think that this is, this is the important stuff. It is because of this stuff that mindfulness and concentration and insight help us to realize this. But this is the real stuff. This is the foundation. When you get the foundation right, then it all flows. If you don't get the foundation right, it'll always be wobbly. It'll always be hit or miss. It'll always be on and off. We all know that, don't we? Yeah. So, some people think, the four mind trainings, bodhicitta, basic stuff, like grade school dharma. I want the Zen Dzogchen stuff. This is the big stuff. The other stuff will just come, but this is the setting. If you have a beautiful gemstone, you don't want to put it on a cheap plastic ring, do you? You want to have a beautiful ring, so when the gemstone is put in, it really sets it off. So when we receive the pristine teachings about the nature of mind, that's the jewel, but the setting is this. The setting is our life. Good. Enough belaboring.